Welcome to this special WHYY production, Out of the Shadows. I'm Mike and Scott. We will never be the same. That sentiment was shared by many Americans after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. The events were too devastating, too overwhelming. We had lost too many lives and witnessed too much. How would we go on? As the nation struggled with the aftermath, it became clear that the traumatic events in New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania would take an emotional toll on all Americans. Government officials scrambled to organize a mental health response.
I was the deputy director of the National Center for Children Exposed to Violence at that time, and within minutes, we were receiving phone calls from the Justice Department.
Makeshift counseling centers sprung up, offering guidance for anybody dealing with the after effects.
Our church, they had a counseling center, so they brought in a lot of therapists, and they sort of used that as a therapy triage area.
And a term from psychology became a buzzword on the news.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, has been around for a while. Its symptoms include feelings of fear.
Just like when you have a wound on your hand. At first,
so what have we learned about addressing and treating the emotional aspects of trauma in the last decade? Can people recover after traumatic experiences? And what treatments work for PTSD? How can governments, communities, and organizations respond to people's mental health needs during crises? Let's take a look.
Good morning. 64 degrees at 8 o'clock. It's Tuesday, September 11th. I'm Lee Harris. Here's what's happening. It's primary.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, Bucks County native Sherry Brummonds was taking her kids to the Independence School in their Manhattan neighborhood, a few blocks from the World Trade Center. Her son Bradley was 10, her daughter Kirsten 7. 10 years later, they recall what happened next.
I was taking them to school. The alleyways are pretty, narrow. And all of a sudden, the alley got very, very dark. We looked up, and I could see the underbelly of the plane, and then seemed like a second later it had crashed. So I ran them to their school and thought that they were safe there and came back down. I didn't have a cell phone with me, so I went down to the street level to use the payphone to call Anthony, my husband. And I couldn't get a hold of him because, obviously, phones were crazy that day after the event. And as I was on the street, I think it was the second tower was hit, but I don't know for sure because it kind of came around the other way. But all this debris sort of flew out onto the street, and I watched a guy get his head kind of sliced open with a 2x4. And at that point, I realized I thought the kids were safe in that building, but it was too close. So I ran back up to get them. And at the same time, my husband had seen the first plane crash because he was up on our roof. So he had gotten Bradley out of class and I had gotten Kirsten. And we actually, by chance, met in the stairwell of the school. And then we spent the rest of the day sort of going from place to place.
Since I was young, I remember really weird details that there were really little. I just remember people I thought they were falling out of the building, but I guess they were jumping out of the building. And I remember there were shoes everywhere on the ground. I guess people just couldn't keep running with their shoes, and they kept falling off high heels and stuff like that. So there were shoes all over the ground and clothes. And I remember we had to run a lot. I have cystic fibrosis, and that's a lung disease. So I remember being afraid that I wasn't able to run with everybody else, and I was afraid I wasn't going to get away from whatever was falling at the time.
Well, we went home to get things like her medication and some cell phones and things like that. And then we went to his office. And at that point, then one of the towers collapsed. And then that was about 3 blocks from the Trade Center, would you guys say? Down on John, two blocks? Yeah. We were under a desk when that happened. That was one of the most frightening moments of the day, I think.
It was just a wave of smoke coming at us.
One of the things I remember the most when we were under that desk was watching her leg shake. Her leg would not stop shaking. She was out of control of it. And there's been many times since then that when she's scared, that same thing happened, but it never happened prior to 9/11.
I remember being in the street when the second building fell, and there was someone, he had water bottles, I guess, that he was carrying around in a shopping cart. So my mom, my stepdad were helping him, and I remember sliding in the street because you couldn't walk right, and then stopping and looking up and seeing the second building fall.
And Bradley turned to me in that moment and he said, "Mom, I hope that the firemen have a big enough trampoline," because in the old-fashioned movies when someone's jumping from a burning building and they're all holding the trampoline. And then later that night, I was putting the kids to bed once we were in Brooklyn, and Bradley looked up at me and he said, "Mom, I figured it out." And I said, "What, honey?" And he said, "Those people that today that were jumping, they had to decide how to die." I said, "What do you mean, honey?" And he goes, "Well, they either had to burn or jump."
Sherry Brummonds with her children, Bradley and Kirsten Sills, remembering the morning of September 11th. Children were very much on Steven Berkowitz's mind that day. At the time, the UPenn psychiatry professor was working in Connecticut at the National Center for Children Exposed to Violence.
We immediately actually started writing guidelines for parents and teachers about how to talk to the children appropriately about what was going on and at various developmental levels. And so we had a lot of concerns about that, a lot of concerns about the media, and particularly how that would affect children and how folks and families needed to not expose their children to too much media and how to help them process what they did see and what they did understand at the times.
What generally happens to children who witness this kind of violence? I mean, I'm sure there's not one response, but what tends to happen to kids, whether they witness it in person or on TV?
Well, it obviously can vary tremendously based on developmental age and you know, capacities, also in terms of prior histories and so on and so forth. I think maybe the best anecdote that I can give you is about 3 days later, it was September 14th, I went into New York City and was the expert on the Nick News, which is was a show that was, you know, Nickelodeon did for children, and it was about 9/11. And many of the kids that were participating had been in the school that was across the street from the towers. And I would say just about every one of them was having difficulty sleeping, felt more irritable, and just generally anxious and upset. And, you know, we know that people's pathways really vary tremendously after an exposure to these kinds of events, really depending on previous history, their own constitution, the support or lack of support that they receive. And so we were very concerned about those kids and continued to do some work with them. And we were also very concerned about kids who were watching this on the media over and over again.
While trauma expert Steven Berkowitz worried about the mental health of kids, Northwestern University psychologist Roxanne Cohen-Silver was thinking about America's mental health in general. About 9 days after the attacks, she started to study a large sample of Americans.
In general, our research suggests that the attacks of 9/11 spilled over beyond just the directly impacted communities of New York, Washington, D.C., and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We found that the attacks had effects beyond those who were merely directly exposed. That is, that there were national consequences of the attacks.
Such as?
Symptoms of post-traumatic stress. There were increased ruminations about the attacks, some attempts to avoid thinking about the attacks, and a sense of anxiety when reminders came into their mind. And over time, we saw some elevations in physical consequences that we attribute to the attacks. We were fortunate to have information about our sample that had been collected prior to the attacks, so we could, in fact, look at changes pre to post 9/11.
And what were some of the physical changes you saw?
We saw an increase in the number of physical ailments that people reported in the 3 years after 9/11. We saw an increase in healthcare utilization. And in fact, we found that there was an increase in new onset cardiovascular ailments in general amongst individuals who continued to worry about terrorism.
Silver followed this group for 3 years. In 2005, she started to follow another group of several thousand Americans for another 3 years. Here's what she found.
in general, most people in our country are not continuing to experience 9/11 related symptomatology. So in general, we have found great resilience amongst the American populace in terms of the 9/11 attacks specifically, but we now have a new understanding of the threats to the United States.
Roxanne Cohen-Silver's research indicates that the emotional effects of traumatic events typically diminish over time, but some people who are directly exposed to a traumatic event cannot move on. They develop post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. University of Pennsylvania psychiatry professor Edna Foa is one of the world's leading researchers on PTSD. I asked her to first describe what constitutes a traumatic event.
A traumatic event is an experience that a person has that has an aspect of life-threatening or injury to oneself or to other people. So the person either experiences it themselves, like being attacked, or a person can witness somebody else and be traumatized by watching other people being killed or, you know, being attacked.
When is a person's response to a traumatic event considered to be just a regular human reaction to a horrific event? And at what point does it become something that we would call a disorder?
Majority of people in our studies that have been raped would have the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. 94% in our study, in the first week after the assault.
And what are those symptoms?
An example of a symptom is flashbacks, that you actually can see or smell part of the event. Intrusive thoughts about the event, nightmares. Feeling afraid when something reminds you of the event. And then avoiding places or situations that are trauma reminders, and attempt to avoid to think about the trauma, feeling always on guard. So those are kind of some of the symptoms. And so those symptoms, many people have them immediately or shortly after a traumatic event. Over time, the majority of people actually recover. And when I say recover, I don't mean that they forget that they've been, that they were traumatized. They do remember it, and when they remember it, they are sad and they feel bad. Right? But recovery means that those memories don't haunt the person, and that they are able to function in daily life.
Edna Foa is a leading trauma researcher at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, why does recovery happen for some but not for others?
I have a picture in my head that it never goes away.
What kinds of treatments help those who continue to suffer? I'm Mike and Scott, and you're listening to a WHYY special production, Out of the Shadows.
Who are you having dinner with on September 24th? Join media sponsor WHYY for an evening with 30 of Greater Philadelphia's leaders in business, government, and not-for-profits at Mount Airy USA's annual Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, an event to support community revitalization efforts in Philadelphia. For more information, visit www.guesswhoscomingtodinner.org. www.guesswhoscomingtodinner.org.
It's back to school time, and that means homework. It's a hugely pesky topic for many families, but it doesn't have to ruin your evenings and weekends. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us on September 13th for the first event in our new WHYY parenting series. Experts, educators, and parents will develop strategies for kids and families to get homework done. September 13th at 6:30 p.m. here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member-experience.
Thursday, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's address before a joint session of Congress. Mr. Obama will talk about the economy and his jobs creation plan. Join Michelle Norris for in-depth coverage and analysis. That's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's address before a joint session of Congress.
tomorrow night at 7 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Out of the Shadows, a WHYY special production. We're discussing what we have learned about emotional trauma since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. On that day, Aramark employee Anne-Marie Queso was working on the 107th floor of the World Trade Center's South Tower. After the first plane hit the North Tower, she and seven co-workers made their way down to the 78th floor to get to the lobby.
Four of us got in one elevator and four of us got in another, and my elevator got to the lobby just as the plane hit the South Tower. And it hit just about on the 78th floor. So of the eight of us who were up there who worked for Aramark, four got to the lobby and only three of us got out alive. One of our cashiers was killed trying to get out of the building.
How so?
We don't know. We don't know, because it was such chaos in the lobby. Everybody was just told, run, run, run. And there were so many people that you got separated. So we don't know.
As she tried to get away from the World Trade Center, Queso thought she was going to perish in a heavy cloud of smoke and dust. But eventually, she made it home.
Covered in soot, covered in what felt like cement, but home and safe, one of the lucky ones.
For the next 3 months, Queso struggled with the question of why she had lived and her co-workers died. This has been called survivor's guilt, common among soldiers or concentration camp survivors. She also couldn't sleep, was jumpy, anxious, and hated crowds. But then, with the help of counseling, her symptoms began to subside. As we heard from researcher Edna Foa earlier, this is what typically happens, but between 15 and 20% of people who experience trauma develop post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. That means the symptoms persist months and years after the event. This anxiety disorder was first defined in the wake of the Vietnam War. It was actually first called post-Vietnam syndrome. It's gotten a lot of renewed attention lately because of the many soldiers returning from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
We never had such long wars. I mean, even Vietnam.
Psychiatrist Edna Foa knows the symptoms of PTSD by heart. Veteran Marine Tony Ricosi is living with them every day.
An example of a symptom is flashbacks.
A loud noise pops behind you, and you're an absolute mess. You shake.
Intrusive thoughts about David.
It's kind of like if you're watching a film, and then you hit pause.
Sleeplessness, difficulty sleeping.
It wouldn't happen during the day. It would happen when I shut my eyes at night.
Feeling always on guard.
To me, everyone's suspicious.
An attempt to avoid to think about the trauma.
I was self-medicating, drinking.
Tony Ricosi has lived intensely the consequences of 9/11. He grew up in Bucks County and joined the Marines in 2004. He was deployed to violent, volatile Fallujah, Iraq in 2005. During a raid, he injured his right knee and subsequently got an infection that severely damaged his heart. He underwent open-heart surgery and was honorably discharged. As he left the Marine Corps, it turned out that his heart problem was only one of his worries.
The day I checked out from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, when I came home, it started then. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life because, you know, I was told I couldn't do law enforcement. Emotionally wise, it was, it hurt. It really hurt because right before I got out, my unit deployed for the second time, and I wasn't able to deploy at that time. And when they deployed the second time, my unit went to Ramadi, and a couple of my close friends didn't make it. And to sit here in the States knowing that maybe I could have changed something, so I kind of feel like these are the guys that I was with. It's a brotherhood there. It's a family, you know? And when I got out, I was an emotional wreck, and I didn't feel like I fit in. I came home to my friends that I used to, you know, hang out with before the Marine Corps, and nothing was the same. I had a few friends that I grew up with that told me I was a different person. You know, that's not something that you want to hear from somebody you grew up with. So then I found myself isolating. I didn't like to leave the house. like loud noises were bothering me. I mean, I couldn't sleep. It was terrible.
Was there a situation that sticks in your mind from your deployment
that bothers me? I think the biggest thing that bothered me when I was there was seeing children being hurt. And I have a picture in my head that it never goes away. I have a 12-year-old kid with half of his face missing. And
we'll take a break.
No, go ahead. Because you know what? Go ahead. It's all right. I have to deal with it. So it's just a picture that you just can't imagine, you know?
Did your unit lose guys? Did you lose your friends too?
Yeah, three close friends of mine, and actually one of them was from here and from Pennsylvania. I was roadside bomb. I wasn't scared of being shot over there. I was scared of being blown up, because those explosions over there were bad.
When you first came back and you were experiencing symptoms, was it always there, or was it more like a panic attack where it would suddenly come over you?
It was more of a panic attack, and it would happen. It wouldn't happen during the day. It would happen when I shut my eyes at night. And when I shut my eyes at night, you know, it was so bad. I'd wake up and my shirt would be soaked in sweat. I mean, shaking, and it's horrifying, you know. And when I first came home, I didn't get channeled right in for help, and you know, I didn't want to live. I didn't want to live anymore.
We'll hear a hopeful update on veteran Marine Tony Ricozzi in a moment. Earlier on, we heard from Sherry Brummins, who was living near the World Trade Center in 2001. Her son and daughter, who were 10 and 7 at the time, witnessed the attacks. Both have struggled with mental health issues since. Brad, who is 20 now, developed obsessive-compulsive disorder. He described his symptoms here with his mother, Sherry.
Touching things, they don't feel like clean or whatever. Like it just feels off. Like my hands feel like there's something on them. Things like that. Like I'm really OCD about my phone.
He worries incessantly about things. Like he would call me like in the middle of a school day because he might be afraid of taking PSSAs or whatever the testing, and I would sort of talk him through turning off the tape. So one of the things that we saw with his OCD was that he couldn't turn off the incessant, you know, thoughts of the same tape running through his head over and over again.
Certain things like diseases like cancer, something like that, like I'm always afraid like something like that's going to happen, and there's like no real reason to be afraid of it. Like I can't control it. So
Bradley's sister Kirsten is 17 and has also struggled on and off with mental health issues.
I honestly don't think I ever even talked about it until last summer. And then last September 11th, actually, I was babysitting, and there were fireworks going off, and I just had, I freaked out, and I had to call the parents and had to tell them to come home, and they had to take me home, and I just started getting really scared. And then I would have issues where every time a student in class would bring up September 11th, I would start crying, I'd have to leave and things like that. But I feel like I've gotten a lot better with it. But I think last year was probably the hardest for me.
Kirsten and Brad Sills are coping with their symptoms with the help of treatment. The question remains, though, why did they develop long-lasting symptoms while Anne Caso, who narrowly escaped the World Trade Center, did not? One reason could be their age at the time of the traumatic event. Researchers are trying to determine the risk factors for PTSD or other lasting mental health issues. Psychologist Roxanne Cohen-Silver of Northwestern University says demographics are part of the equation.
Gender, women are more likely than men. That's not to say that men don't experience these kinds of symptoms, but women tend to be more likely. Individuals who have previously experienced some mental health difficulties are more at risk for ongoing psychological consequences. Individuals who have a lot of chronic stress in their lives, low income, a lot of other negative experiences. So we see that there are a variety of factors that can help us predict who might be more at risk than others.
The good news for people who do develop persistent symptoms of PTSD is that this disorder is one of the more treatable mental health conditions, as long as people have access to treatment. During a time of deep despair, veteran Marine Tony Ricozzi reached out to his congressman at the time, fellow veteran Patrick Murphy, who connected him to resources. Ricozzi started treatment at the VA hospital in Philadelphia and is now receiving a combination of therapy and medications. He is doing better.
I feel like there's hope now. And before, I didn't feel like I had hope. I have a little girl now. She is my motivator. You know, she's my world. I love her more than anything.
You've sustained severe physical wounds from your time as a soldier, but which ones are harder, the emotional wounds or the physical wounds?
I mean, most people would tell you, oh, no, I would never want to have my heart, my chest ripped open and my heart pulled out, but that's nothing. I would do it 6 times to get rid of the way I feel emotionally. The emotional wounds are a lot worse. It's just like I always used to say, I wish they could just, like, zap my head, like, zap my brain and erase everything.
Erase everything. Or learn to live with the memories. One PTSD treatment is prolonged exposure therapy, which was developed by Dr. Edna Foa at the University of Pennsylvania. Foa says those who develop PTSD tend to avoid thinking about the trauma and recoil from places and activities that remind them of the trauma. So this therapy has a two-prong approach.
What the therapist is asking the patient to do is to tell the traumatic story aloud in lots of details, including the emotional details, how they feel, what they were thinking at the time. And they don't tell it once, they repeatedly telling it. And that allows the patient to get new perspective about what the trauma was, what really happened there. And it allows them to change their perception about the world and about themselves. It also allows them to realize that this memory is a memory. It's not happening now.
The therapy also involves gradually returning to places and activities that the person has been avoiding, the movies or a crowded public place. Reclaiming these activities allows patients to build confidence that the world is not an unsafe place. Prolonged exposure therapy is an important part of treatment, but doesn't always work as a starting point, says Drexel University trauma expert Dr. Sandra Bloom.
It can take a long time to get somebody willing, just willing to experience exposure treatment, even though as a therapist I may know that's exactly what they need. The person has to be willing to actually engage.
Giving people strategies to cope with symptoms is important.
We know that cognitive behavioral approaches are really effective. What cognitive behavioral kinds of approaches will do is have people use their thoughts to help them calm down and help them develop skills that they can use when they get frightened so that they can stay in a situation and relax and calm down and breathe and do very simple physiological things that help your body calm down so you don't keep getting that stimulation that's all around you all the time.
Medications can help people cope with certain aspects of PTSD, but Bloom says there are no magic bullets to cure PTSD. Treatment has to be very individualized and can be a journey with many steps.
A trauma changes your life, or it wouldn't be called a trauma. And that means that it can affect your biology, your psychology, your social adaptation, and your spiritual connection, your philosophical meaning that you make out of life. And therefore, the problems can come at a different kind of pace. So somebody might initially come into treatment because they are overwhelmed, they can't sleep. Then as time goes on, they may have more difficulty with their emotional adaptation, trying to make sense out of what happened to them. And then it may profoundly affect the way they have relationships or refuse to have any meaningful relationships with other people because they've seen people die, and they don't want to lose people that they love again. They don't want to go through grief again. So they're all interwoven. It doesn't mean that somebody has to be in treatment forever. But there may be times where the past trauma rears its head again, and it's another challenge. It's a kind of a life challenge of how am I going to incorporate this into who I am as a person.
Drexel University trauma expert Dr. Sandra Bloom. Close to 200,000 veterans of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been treated for PTSD to date. That's just veterans, not those still in the military. In 2004, West Point psychologist Michael Matthews became interested in positive psychology, which focuses on people's emotional strength and overall resilience. He began to wonder if it might be possible to mentally prepare soldiers for battle in a way that would help them cope with adversity. He helped develop a program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. In this program, resilience is broken down into four areas: emotional fitness, how you react to adversity and challenge; social resilience or social network; family resilience and resources; and spiritual resources or a sense of meaning and purpose. Soldiers assess how they score in these four areas in a computer test, a so-called global assessment tool.
Every single soldier in the Army has either taken or will soon take this global assessment tool. As they sit down at the computer and take this test, they get immediate feedback of where they stand compared to others, what the norms are. And then if they happen to score kind of low on one of them, then the program suggests some remedial actions they can take to build resilience in one or more of those areas.
Like what? Like what might the tool suggest to me?
There are online training tools which run through. So think about emotional resilience. Part of emotional resilience is how do you attribute cause when bad things happen? For example, if something bad happens to you in life, if you say, you know, it's my fault, it's never going to go away, and I can't make it any better, that's not a very resilient sort of reaction to that event. It's better to teach a person to interpret bad events as being, you know, probably not going to last forever, and you know what, it's probably something you can overcome, and it probably wasn't your fault. So you sort of change how people frame the cause of bad events. That would be one example.
So you're confident that you could teach people to be resilient, that it's not about who a person is at core, but that we can learn to change that part of us.
I think that at a very theoretical basis, heredity and constitution set some left and right limits, maybe. But within those limits, education, training, and learning can shift in the right direction. I don't want to suggest that you could take any human being and make them, like, bulletproof. But these are concrete skills that anybody can learn to help them do better. You're never going to do away with depression and PTSD and suicide, but you should decrease the frequency of it. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, increase the numbers of people who are doing, instead of doing, you know, kind of, sort of well, they're doing pretty well.
Michael Matthews is a psychologist at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Coming up, we explore how communities respond to the emotional aspects of crises and the lessons learned since 9/11.
What doesn't work is when you have various groups rushing in to help and tripping all over one another.
I'm Mike and Scott, and you're listening to a WHYY special production, Out of the Shadows.
Penswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Penswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, Type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
To families of 9/11 victims, some things don't come easier with time.
You know, you never really leave that place. You know, you kind of learn to live with it, but you never really leave it.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for We Remember, StoryCorps Stories from 9/11. Produced with the National 9/11 Memorial and Museum, StoryCorps, and NPR.
Sunday night at 6 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A massive deficit, wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, American leaders at each other's throats. Did Osama bin Laden win? Also, a new Porgy and Bess is getting raves, but the story is problematic for many African Americans, so what's it like to play Porgy today? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Out of the Shadows. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how people respond emotionally to traumatic events. Since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, many large-scale disasters have affected communities all over the world. Hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes, tornadoes, random shootings. So, what have we learned about addressing the emotional aspects of these crises in the last decade? In the frantic hours and days after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Stephen Berkowitz gathered information for parents and educators on how to talk to kids about the events. He had never dealt with a crisis of this magnitude, and there were no instructions or manuals in his desk drawer.
No, not at that point. We had some guidelines. There were certainly treatment manuals. Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy certainly existed. There were some crisis response protocols that existed. Lots of different things were being done. There was not the kind of uniformity of understanding of what we meant by traumatic responses, what the treatments should be, what early interventions may be most effective. And that really has evolved over the last 10 years.
What do we have now?
In terms of large-scale events, there have been a number of very well-done manuals written. There's the Skills for Psychological Recovery that is for weeks or months after a large-scale disaster that's been employed a great deal recently. And then there are several psychological first aid manuals. How do you take care of yourself? How do you self-soothe? How do you learn to relax, orient, stabilize? Those are the kind of the early interventions that are done currently in these situations.
What have you learned in terms of what does not work?
Well, there's lots of things that don't work, and there's still things that we don't do. So one of the sine qua nons of the traumatic moment is a feeling of complete lack of control and helplessness. And one of the most important things to do is to try to provide external authority and control. So what doesn't work is when you have various groups, various agencies rushing in to help and tripping all over one another. And that certainly happened in 9/11. So what we know is that really an incident command structure is really crucial, that using law enforcement and others in order to contain and organize the situation is really important, and that rushing in and trying to do too much too soon is really contraindicated.
The manual studies and lessons Stephen Berkowitz just mentioned were a lifeline for Christopher Flynn. He directs the Thomas Cook Student Counseling Center at Virginia Tech University. He came to Virginia Tech in 2006. His prior college was in New Orleans and was devastated during Hurricane Katrina. In April of 2007, Flynn received terrible news.
I came to work on the morning of April 16th and quickly get a call from Residential Life, from the director, asking me to come over to one of the residence halls to West Ambler Johnson, and she had told me that a student had been shot.
As Flynn was comforting students in the residential hall where two students had been shot and killed, he got word of more shootings.
I kept thinking it had to be a mistake or had to be an error, because who ever heard of two separate shootings on a college campus the same day? And then from that time forward, we were busy organizing and reaching out to people who were going to be directly affected by the shootings.
Within hours of the attack, Flynn started to receive resources from colleagues and researchers.
The material that I found most helpful was developed by SAMHSA, actually, and it's called Mental Health Response to Mass Violence and Terrorism, a Training Manual. And if there was one thing I could give people to read to prepare for tragedy of this sort, I would give them that training manual. It's incredibly well done, well written, well-organized, based on research, and it's free.
Flynn says that manual, which was published by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration in 2004, helped him organize and lead a well-coordinated response to the tragedy. Flynn says that in addition to the readily available mental health counseling, what helped heal Virginia Tech was the close community of students and alumni.
80% of students reported knowing, if not knowing one of the injured or deceased, knowing a friend of theirs. There was about 1 degree of separation between the victims and the remainder of the community. Everyone in the community potentially was going to be affected in one way or another, and we certainly worried about the psychological health of the entire community as they struggled to cope with the magnitude of the shooting and this loss. So it's just, you know, I don't know to this day whether I still comprehend how extensive that loss or that the extent of that day was.
Were students terrified to be on campus, to return to class?
That was never my perception. The next day, the president scheduled a convocation to address the community, and it was in Castle Coliseum, which is our basketball arena. And we thought that most of the students would have gone home because classes were canceled. But in any case, that day, Castle Coliseum was full. As you know, the president of the United States came, our two Virginia senators were present, and the campus was full. I mean, Virginia Tech has a really devoted group of students and alum, and I think they're, rather than pull away from the campus, their response in many cases was to come to campus and to see what they could do to help.
Have you had a lot of students who reported symptoms of post-traumatic stress in the years that followed?
Yes, absolutely. Probably 18% or more of students and faculty and staff reported some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it has taken them and the campus a while for them to recover.
What have you learned in terms of responding to a crisis of this magnitude?
In the aftermath of the shooting, the president and provost wanted to make sure that there were counselors available for any faculty member or any student who might be having a difficult time. So we put out a call for volunteers to come and help us in that reopening, and we asked that these people be licensed mental health professionals. We got a tremendous response from our local community service board, and we had other college counselors come from other states to help. And having that happen, I think the resumption of classes went, given the magnitude of the event, went incredibly smoothly.
Talk a bit about your campus. You've mentioned how tight-knit of a community it is. Also, it seems like your alumni population is very involved.
One of the things that impressed me the most in the recovery of the shootings is that all of the students who were shot or were present in the room, apart from those who were too physically injured to do so, came back to Tech and graduated. To me, that's mind-boggling that these students had so much courage and so much composure and so much trust in themselves and in the community that they could come back here and work. And they really led the way.
Christopher Flynn is director of student counseling at Virginia Tech University. The way his school responded to this crisis has become a model for other educational institutions. But how do you cope when disaster shreds a community and destroys the very resources needed to deliver help? In May of this year, a powerful tornado destroyed the town of Joplin, Missouri, and killed 160 people. Mental health professionals tried to reach out and offer guidance and counseling, but faced considerable challenges. Public radio reporter Frank Morris traveled to Joplin and has this report.
Allie Stout's mom and dad desperately shielded her with their bodies and a flapping mattress as one of the most violent and deadly tornadoes on record ripped their small house apart around them. In a few minutes, the three-year-old's world flipped upside down, home in tatters, toys ruined, and scattered, dog missing. Now, like many kids caught in the storm, she plays tornado all the time.
We spin around in circles, and we get a new house, and the line does, and it's blasting off, and we have to run again.
Imaginary friends are left homeless. Sometimes there's a trip to the hospital. This is a story that you hear all over Joplin, at daycares, at recess, in playgroups.
As adults, we often talk things through. A child, particularly younger children, will play things through.
Dr. Charles Graves is a psychiatrist treating children caught in the tornado. Graves says that about a third of the kids who experienced the storm firsthand could be affected by the tornado for the rest of their lives.
Those that have a history of being traumatized before are more likely to experience longer-term problems from the most recent trauma. The more bad things that have happened to you, the worse off you are.
And it's not just kids who are struggling with the emotional aftermath.
With a disaster of this magnitude, you see a significant increase in substance abuse. You see a significant increase in domestic violence. We've already had a significant number of child sexual incidences since the tornado.
Psychologist Vicki Meisler is the vice president for clinical services at the Ozark Center, the big behavioral health group in the region. Since the storm subsided, she's been struggling to provide guidance and support to an emotionally shaken community. The storm destroyed 8 counseling centers and 18,000 cars.
Most of our staff go into homes. They travel. They're in their cars a lot. We had many staff without cars. So we worked with our Department of Mental Health in Missouri, and they immediately dispatched 25 rental cars to us. And that was a huge help.
But it wasn't enough just to get her people into the field. She needed more counselors and quickly realized she was going to need help just managing the flood of those offering to help.
You can tell somebody on the phone that you have a license and not have one.
Another mental health organization set up a website where the volunteers could register and their credentials could be vetted. Meisler says those two things, the registry and the rental cars, were key to getting a grip on the catastrophe. Since then, she's staffed up considerably. Her counselors have made some 38,000 contacts and trained 200 teachers in basic counseling techniques. The next big thing will be a trauma center for children. This is something that Meisler had written a grant proposal to do 2 years ago. It didn't fly then.
You know, Joplin, Missouri wasn't on the map 2 years ago. It is on the map now.
Meisler's getting the Children's Trauma Center off the ground with state money, but expects a boost in federal funding next year. By then, she expects most children who spent the summer compulsively playing tornado to have recovered, and that bouncing back from the disaster will have made her staff more capable than ever to ease traumas much more personal and much more common than those caused by a monster tornado. In Kansas City, Missouri, I'm Frank Morris.
As Public Radio's Frank Morris just reported, emotional trauma doesn't just come in the wake of large-scale disaster and tragedy. Many adults and children living with daily adversities such as poverty and violence experience similar symptoms. They might benefit from the increased attention to trauma treatment, says psychiatrist Stephen Berkowitz.
Yes, undoubtedly. I think that we have refined treatments. We have interventions that are effective, which we didn't have before, or were just starting and didn't get the kind of support and recognition. I think the other side of it is that what we don't do is we don't identify and engage these children and families.
So it seems like if there's a big event, be it a tornado, an attack, we tend to rush in and do something, but not so much in the neighborhoods in our cities or so.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's exactly right. In large cities and poor urban and rural communities, children who are experiencing these events are not getting the kind of attention that they would get, those same children would get if there was a hurricane or a tornado in their neighborhood.
Still, Berkowitz says the field has come a long way since the terrorist attacks of 9/11. In the decades since, researchers have worked together to create a comprehensive approach to the emotional aspects of large-scale traumatic events. More money has been devoted to this issue, and more attention has been paid to it. We've also seen again and again that after a tragedy, many people and communities heal. They come together, pull through, and eventually move on. Psychologist Dan Gottlieb says we are changed by these events, but not necessarily for the worse.
terrorist attacks, hurricanes, earthquakes, accidents, chronic illness, loss of a loved one, no matter what the cause of suffering, our first reaction after the shock is, I can't deal with this. I can't cope. I cannot live with this loss. But, you know, the thing is, with very few exceptions, we can go on, and we do. How do I know this? Well, research shows that to be true, but I know from my own experience. I've lived through a car accident and subsequent paralysis and several deaths in my family. I've lived through despair, hopelessness, and a wish to just close my eyes and never wake up. Many times I thought, I can't live with this. And every time, I did. Trauma affects us, but it doesn't have to define us. Last summer, while sitting in my backyard, I saw a piece of ivy on the bottom of a nearby window. Then I realized that the plant itself was on the inside of the house. That little piece of ivy burrowed through the drywall, insulation, and stucco to find its way to the sun. And that's what I learned from living with multiple traumas. I learned that as sure as the ivy found its way to the sun, with each trauma, we heal. And over time, I've come to have faith in the resilience and the life-affirming force of the human spirit.
Many share the hope expressed by Dan Gottlieb.
I don't have a feeling that 9/11 has destroyed our lives. I just know that it's impacted us greatly.
You have a sense of to enjoy what time you have and to be a little bit more happy.
I feel like there's hope now. And before, I didn't feel like I had hope.
A traumatic experience, by definition, is a transformative experience. We get to choose whether that is going to destroy us or whether out of that trauma we are going to create something new.
I'm Mike and Scott, and you've been listening to Out of the Shadows, a WHYY special production.